Cool. Well, let's get started. I want to go ahead and start. I have 3 minutes after, and that's enough. This is Bill Blatchford with Blatchford Solutions. Tonight, we are going to interview Dr. Rai Spohr and talk to him about his very unique practice. Dr. Spohr is actually my personal dentist and has been a friend and client for quite a while, I think 12 or 14 years. And he has developed a practice that is a very niche practice in Seattle. For those of you that know Seattle very well, it's a very competitive market at the high end. It's very competitive at the low end. It's very competitive in the middle. Boeing Aircraft has 135,000 employees. They all have Delta, and so that's 500,000 people, roughly, that are on that plan alone. At the high end, so that's the middle end of the market. At the high end of the market, you have, besides Rise, you have people like David Baird, Frank Spear, John Coy, Karen McConnor O'Neill, and a few others that I haven't named. So the high end of that market is extremely competitive, and Dr. Spohr has put together a practice. It may not be the practice that any of you want. It may be something that some of you want. It may be part of what he does you might want. He does not really do any general dentistry at this point. He is a general dentist by training. He is not a prosthodontist, although he does more prosthetics than most prosthodontists. He does extremely difficult cases. He gets a good fee for those cases. I had the opportunity to have Rise as my wingman a year ago last summer. I did 10 anterior crowns for my wife. I had that handpiece in my hand for 18 years, and he had a very well-trained dental assistant who led me through the procedure. And then Rise, of course, came in and checked. This summer I prepped 10 veneers for our daughter, who was in her second year of dental school in his office. While I was prepping my daughter, he was seating a 28-unit case. And she had been referred down from a former client of mine and a client of Rise, one of Rise's students in Vancouver, British Columbia. So this patient had driven 5 hours, had to cross international border, three trips down for a 28-unit case, and I would say that she was a bit of a management problem. And at the end of the day, Rise very calmly said that's what he gets paid for. So Rise, I'm going to ask you to kind of trace your history a little bit from where we started with you 12 years ago, where you were practicing, and what your vision was at that time, and a little bit about it, and then I'm going to ask you some more questions. We'll have some people in the audience ask questions as well. As you come onto the phone, if you could hit the 6 button on your phone, on your keypad on your phone, that will mute your microphone on your phone, and then we don't have any background noise. And then when we open it up for questions, that the person that wants to ask a question, if you could just hit the 6 button again, and then introduce yourself and a question for either Rise or myself. Rise, could you start by recounting a little bit the journey that you've taken in the last few years?
Well, we started working together in 1993, and I had graduated from University of Washington in 1983, so I'd been in practice about 10 years. And to tell you the truth, when I met Bill, I didn't sign up for Bill's program right away. I actually heard of him about 4 years before I actually approached him about becoming my coach. And it's partly because I thought he was way too expensive for what he did. I mean, this is a guy that had a lot of ideas, but I didn't see any meat to it. So I'd go to some of these free seminars that he was giving at the local labs, and I'd listen to him, and I kind of try to take tidbits of it, take it back to the practice. And what I found out is that it didn't work very well if I was the only one that wanted to do it.
So the only one meaning?
The only one in the office. I mean, I had this grand idea of where I wanted to go and where I wanted to go.
Could you speak just a little louder?
Sure. Where I wanted to go was... Is that better?
Yes.
Where I wanted to go was I had this vision that I wanted to have people fly in to Seattle to do this elaborate dental work. And I realized where I was in a suburb of Seattle. It was an area called Ballard. And I had a good, solid general practice. We did lots of insurance work. We did basically a crown or two at a time. A lot of children. Just a mix, and it was solid. But I couldn't really imagine people wanting to fly to Seattle to see a dentist like that. So I knew after seeing some other people that had practices like I thought I'd want to do, that I was going to have to move. And that's one of the first things that we did after I started with Bill is I actually moved the office to a downtown position. And I'm now on the 46th floor of a high-rise in downtown Seattle. And truthfully, sometimes we might as well be on Mars. I mean, we don't have walk-by traffic.
A few window washers.
We have a few window washers, yeah. Because people don't know we're there. We've got a great view, and the facility itself is like a lot of your facilities are. It's state-of-the-art. We've got pretty much anything anyone else has. However, what really makes ours unique is the view. But if you're looking at our office from the street, you wouldn't know we're there. There's no outside signage. There's no easy parking. Everything about it's kind of difficult. In fact, to get to the office, you have to take three banks of elevators to get there. So we really live and die now by our marketing and the referrals that we've generated from other clients. So in this process, what I realized is that I needed to become more skillful. So I started taking a lot of courses in aesthetics. I took a lot of courses locally in the Seattle area. I was at LVI for several years, became an instructor, and found out, in fact, I realized this when I was first out of dental school, I really like to teach. And the best way to develop a command of your subject is to be able to teach it to somebody else. So after doing a little of that, a lot more trial and error, the practice started to develop. We started doing marketing. What it is now is it's a fairly unique practice. We truly have a cosmetic practice. We don't have people call us ever to come get their teeth cleaned.
As a matter of fact, how much hygiene do you have?
We have a day of hygiene a week, and even that's hard to keep full. People tend to come into the practice, we do their work, and then they go back to wherever they came from. I would say that 100% of the people that come into my practice have a dentist. Now, some of them referred, some of them find me through the marketing, but the record right now for the person that's come the furthest is I had a guy come from London. And he flew back and forth four times to do the procedures. And his brother, actually a client of Bill's, is a dentist in London.
I should mention here that the doctor in London became a client of mine after Rise started to treat his brother.
Mm-hmm.
He came over with his brother one time, met me, and became a client, and is trying to become a private dentist in London, where it's public health service. But this doctor found Rise on the internet, was doing a sabbatical or some training in Vancouver, and came down from Vancouver for basically a full mouth case and some implant supported. Rise, tell us a little bit about the niche that you do besides cosmetics, because yes, it's cosmetics, but you certainly do a lot of reconstruction.
Well, I don't look at our practice as being a cosmetic practice, although it's what draws people. I look at our practice as being a restorative practice, and I mean that in the true sense of the word restorative. We're restoring health function, and for a lot of people, we restore a psychological deficiency that they had sometimes their whole life. Sometimes it's fairly recent. But I do a lot of removable prosthetics. We do a lot of implants. We happen to put cosmetics with it, and that's where the art form comes in. But the simple fact is that if you don't have really well-functioning teeth, they don't hold up. I don't care who does the cosmetics. And, you know, when you look at the history of especially prosthetic practices, they've always been based on function coming first. And I will say for a while in my career, I got away from that. I started thinking that, you know, the main thing was how it looks is the most important. But these types of clients pay a lot of money for this. And they expect a lot more than your typical patient that comes in and maybe does a crown, pays a partial fee for it because maybe their insurance covers part of it. They expect a lot. And the thing about these kinds of practices are that when you do a cosmetic case, I had a professor in dental school that said the best way to have a reconstruction practice, but you could substitute a cosmetic practice, is to move every 5 years and don't leave your forwarding address. Because in some ways, you know, these people have high expectations, and it's always better to under-promise and over-deliver. But no matter what you say, no matter what kind of paperwork you have them sign in, as far as consents and expectations, they'll always expect more. So what happens is that if you look down the road, a success is not when they walk out the door and say, oh, I love my smile. A success is 5, 10, 15 years later, they come back and they still love what you did.
Mm-hmm.
Because they will find you, whether or not you have a practice like mine. And I will tell you that most of you probably won't want to do what I'm doing. On the other hand, you all have patients that trust you, and there are a number of those that you can really enhance their lives by paying attention to some of the details and doing some nice cosmetics. But it should always be based on the premise of these people are going to find you. They're going to come back next month. They're going to come back next year. They're going to come back in 10 years. And that's what you really want. You want stability in the practice.
Rise, let's address the issue of the vision that you had was to be a dentist. You wanted people flying into Seattle to see you. You wanted to do the cases that a lot of people didn't want to tackle. And today you've certainly accomplished that. I mean, you're doing several full mouth reconstructions a month. I know you've had cases that are between 60 and 100, and I think you've broken $100,000 on a few cases. Tell us, once the vision was in place, how did you get a team? I'm reading the book. And a chapter in the book, and a young doctor that is a client of mine that took one of your courses in Seattle, said, I want my staff to praise me like Rise's team members do, and I want them to sell me. This summer, when I was there in your office, I heard Maria, who basically answers number one on the phone for you, and she was talking to a patient that had found you on the Internet, and she asked a question that we have had a lot of our clients ask, is where are you in the research? And she found out the patient already decided to have a cosmetic procedure, and now she was selecting a dentist. And she, Maria said to her, well, Dr. Spohr has probably done more veneers than anyone in Seattle, and we have literally hundreds of photographs of patients we have done. And she also said, and we're probably going to be the highest fee for anybody you're going to talk to. She said, I'd like you to go to the other two dentists first, get their estimates, and then come here before you make up your mind, and I promise you, the experience you have here will be different in any place you go. Well, when she got off the phone with the client, with that potential client, I asked her, and I says, "What did she ask? What did the patient ask?" And she said, "Well, I want someone who has a lot of experience. I want that can show me photographs of actual patients, and economics are an important factor." And Maria had the confidence to say, "We will be the highest bidder." And I promise you, you'll have a fantastic experience. How did you get a team of people to all go the same direction at the same time at the same speed?
Well, when I first started practice, I thought it was important that the people I worked with liked me. And I can tell you, the employees that work for me now, they like me to a point, but they don't like me as a friend. They respect my abilities as a good clinician and in my professional judgment. And I really think that's something I didn't quite understand at first. I kept a receptionist once for probably, two or three years longer than I should have.
I remember her.
Yeah, I know. And I really liked her, and I wanted to help her out. But she wasn't helping my vision, and she certainly didn't help the practice. And it was partly because she didn't quite have the sophistication or the understanding of where I was and where the people that we served, where we wanted to take them. And these people that come in for this kind of work, they really want to trust you. They want to feel that they're getting value for it. It really has little to do with the total cost, although from a business standpoint, you have to make these cases worth your while to do, because I have an unwritten guarantee. Sometimes I actually have to put this in writing. But the unwritten guarantee is I will work with the patient until they're satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean I always make money at it. In fact, right now I have a patient I saw last night, and she's a thorn in my side, really. I wish I'd never touched this case.
Okay.
At this point, if I figured out the plain economics of it for the time I've spent and what I've made from it, I would have been better off with this woman if she had come in and I'd given her a check for probably close to $42,000 right now.
And said, number, take this to a dentist of your choice.
Oh, absolutely. And that number keeps going up. And I don't know how I'm ever going to satisfy her, because some of these cases aren't about dentistry. Now, the good part is that for most of you on the phone right now, is you're not going to deal with clients like this. You're going to filter them out. And that's one thing that it's good to say no sometimes. Just because you think you might be able to do it, you need to really delve into what they're after, and their characteristics that they tend to have. If they're so focused, for example, if you're doing a consult with a patient, and one of the things we do all the time is we have a mirror close by. If that mirror stays on the countertop and the patient never reaches for it when they're telling me something about their smile, I'm a little skeptical at that. I think that's something that if they're trying to point something out, they need to be showing me what they're pointing out. On the other hand, if that mirror comes up, one of the first things they're doing, and I can't see their face, the mirror's in front of it, I actually have to push it away to see them, that tells me something about that person. And sometimes they're so focused on their teeth that maybe they're not solvable. And if you're not doing this all the time like we do, I probably wouldn't even do that case. I'd refer them to someone else in my area that has perhaps the experience, not maybe the experience to do the case technically any better than you can do, but to deal with the psychological part that comes afterwards. Can they be satisfied? Some can.
Well, are there some cases that are rewarding that you take on that are easy? You've talked about the difficult ones.
Absolutely. The majority are easier, and that's the good part. But it's a bell curve.
Yes.
Most of them are in the center. There's
Bill?
Some that are extremely
yes.
Easy.
It's really tough to hear him.
Speak louder, right?
It's like really unclear, kind of muffled.
Okay,
Rise.
Is that better there?
Just really speak loudly, right?
Okay. Maybe it's his phone.
Is that better, Sharon?
Is that better?
It's a little bit better. I don't know what the issue is, but it doesn't sound like your voice, Bill. It sounds like far away.
You know what? Let me just try something here. I'm going to switch to another phone. Tell me if this is better.
Okay.
Okay, is that better? Much better. Okay. Speak louder, though.
Well, so much for the corded phone. So I think it's important to select the patients out of a practice that you're going to try to do cosmetics on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things I learned from Bill right off, is that we would select from our recall system, for example, we would pick a client, maybe one a day, that we were going to try to present what we called ideal treatment. But really what a lot of it revolved around was cosmetics, because people oftentimes want to look better. So we'd approach it from that standpoint. But interestingly enough, when you present the cosmetics and you get everything underneath, again, if you use that concept of form following function, that they become a comprehensive dental case. So they do everything. They do periodontal therapy. They'll do implants. They'll do a lot of things to get that function so they can have the look.
Rise, talk a little bit about how you started to convert regular patients from a general dental practice to larger cosmetic cases.
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to carve out a period of time. And that's one of the things that I didn't quite understand at first. And Bill was quite instrumental in pointing that out. Didn't mean I always reacted to it at first. But the simple fact is, it's not atypical for us, when a new client comes in now, that we'll spend an hour with them, and we don't charge for these. We just take the hour. We understand that that's something in the process that we're going to have to do.
Could you describe the process you go through with a new patient
sure.
a little bit?
Patient makes a phone call. And my receptionist Maria is very good at pulling them into the practice. She spends typically 20 minutes to a half hour on the phone with them. And she finds out a lot of detail about them. But the main thing we're really trying to find out.
Rise, help us out a little bit. What kind of questions does she ask? Because so many people are asking questions about health history and various things. And I've listened to Maria, and what kind of things does she ask?
A very simple question Maria asks is, what can we do for you? And then the obvious next step is to listen to what the answer is. And that's where we sometimes, especially at first, we never really listen to the answer. Because the next thing they say is important, but it also tells you what the next questions you're going to ask are going to be. And they lead you down the path because they already know they're after something.
Mm-hmm.
So once we determine that they're a potential client, the next thing that we do, and I wouldn't necessarily recommend this for every practice, but in our practice, one of the first things she is make sure that they're clear is that they're a qualified candidate. In other words, she wants them to know not only what we do, She wants them to know approximately what it's going to cost.
Yes.
And we've evolved to the point now where every person that walks in knows the fee before they come in the door.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't mean that they...
Now, that may shock a few people on the call, but that's actually a technique that we do, and we teach that to doctors, because my theory is that when you go in to buy a home from a realtor, within 5 minutes, they ask you what your price range is.
Oh, absolutely.
Then they promptly show you homes that are 20% more than that, and the reason I know that is I've taken sales courses with realtors. And you go to buy a present for someone, and they will immediately ask you, what is your price range? And yet in dentistry, for years before we started doing this, I think I'm the only one that teaches this. As a matter of fact, I just spoke at the AAID, the American Academy of Implant Dentists, and there were two other speakers there that speaking on how to sell these large cases, and I was the only one that recommended actually starting to quote fees on the phone and making sure that patient is qualified before they come in. I find many dentists waste about 2 hours of their time, maybe an hour in an exam, an hour in an evening working up a treatment plan, and then on the last 5 minutes of what is very often the last time you ever see the patient, they tell them the fee. So it is a technique that, as Rise is saying, probably not one that everyone should start doing until you learn how to develop the needs, develop and build the value before you do that.
But the whole point of this process is we all have the same goal. In other words, we want to get the patient what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And until you can take time and find out, first of all, what it is, they're not going to take it. But the other thing that's really important during this process is that there's a trust developed, because people will not do any of this kind of treatment unless they trust you.
Yes. Rise, of the hours spent with that patient, how much of that time is time with Maria and how much is your time?
It really varies.
Uh-huh.
If it's someone that Maria has a better relationship with, she might be the majority, perhaps 40 or 45 minutes.
Yeah.
If it's someone that is really analytical and it requires more of my time, I can sometimes spend an hour or sometimes even longer.
Yes.
I try to work it out so that I'll come in approximately 10 minutes after she meets them, and then that determination is made. Now, most of the time when I leave, we do it not in an operatory. We do it in a private setting. It's quiet. It's comfortable. Most of the time after I leave, she'll be with the patient another 10, 20, 30 minutes, sometimes
yes.
an hour. It depends on the person.
Rice?
Yes.
Yes. Can you just summarize very, very briefly what you hope to accomplish in that 1 hour?
Sure. I mean, it's really simple. Are they a client or not?
Not yet. This first hour you're talking about.
That's what I'm saying. What my determination
Oh, that's
is,
the question?
Yeah, well,
that's the answer.
The determination. The answer is, are they a client of mine or not? And that's what happens during the first hour.
Okay, but what components make up that decision?
Well, what components make that is, one, I have to first of all decide if it's a case I want to do. And there are a few that I actually turn away. Not many, but there are a few. The next thing is, I'm trying to develop enough trust in them and find out, first of all, what they want, so I know that I can deliver it and that they'll accept it. In that hour, before they walk out, again, they have a ballpark idea when they walk in what it's going to cost, because it makes no sense to have someone walk in, spend the hour, and then find out that it's not even within their range of ability to afford to do. Now, that doesn't mean we don't give away work. We do sometimes, but when I give away work, I make the decision to do that. Nobody else does. I'm in total control of that. We just did a case here recently where we gave away a $70,000 case because we chose to. I don't want a third party doing that, and that's one of the reasons I got involved with Bill originally, because I was having a third party, specifically an insurance company, and specifically Delta, would say, you know, do the work, and then we'll decide if we're going to pay you or not, and I'm not going to do that anymore. So during that hour, what I'm really after is, I'm showing them that I'm going to pay attention to them as a patient. And this comment comes across consistently. In other words, they'll say, you know, nobody else has spent time with me like this. And even if they don't go ahead and follow through, we've got a relationship, and it's a good relationship. Now, not everybody that sits during that hour decides to do the treatment. I'd say our closure rate right now is about 50%, which is up from what it used to be. It used to be about 30%. But part of that is that, now, some of you may say, well, how can you make a treatment? How can you give an estimate if you haven't done an exam? You don't have the x-rays? And the answer is, I guess.
Rise, tell us a little bit. How much time do you spend doing the clinical exam during that hour?
Oh, maybe a minute.
So in other words, this what I want you to bring up, this hour is spent in a comfortable room. It's not a treatment room, and it's not the exam. It's not the treatment plan.
No, it's not. But what it is, what I do, though, is I always go into a room at the end of that segment. I say, well, let's go up and go in a room where I've got a good light. That's exactly what I say. So I can see in your mouth, because it would be kind of silly for me to tell you all this without looking in your mouth. And, you know, they kind of laugh at that. But see, there's something that comes across in this whole process, and that is absolute confidence. Now, I don't really know at that point whether or not or how I'm going to do the case. What I do know is...
Excuse me a minute, Raj. Sure. Somebody's got a conversation going on in the background. If you could hit the 6 button on your phone, it would help the rest of us so we can hear what Raj is saying.
And by the way, can everybody... Is this phone better now?
It's much better, but you still have to speak louder.
Okay. But what I was saying is that during that consult, it's important that they think I'm actually diagnosing them, even though I'm not technically diagnosing to the full degree. But the fact is, there's only a few ways to do these kinds of treatments. I mean, it may be a combination of doing some implants. It might be removable dentures or partials. It could be a combination of things. It's not just veneers. In fact, we do a lot of veneers, but we do a lot of other dentistry too. It's a comprehensive plan to get them to where they want to be. So I'll go in the room, we'll look in their mouth, say, yeah, that's exactly what I expected. Then what we'll do is we'll set them up to come back for record. That's what we call it. Bill tends to call that the co-diagnosis, but we've shortchanged that in that really we're doing the co-diagnosis in that first appointment.
Yes, you just switched that a little bit.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I think if you've got a practice where you're seeing people that are on a recall system, the one thing you know about those patients already is they trust you because they're back for the recall. The way to approach that is to segment out some time, meaning you don't try to present that treatment at...
I'm sorry to interrupt you guys, but who's ever talking in the background is not hasn't pushed number 6 yet.
Thank you, David.
Oh, I think that worked.
Yeah, that worked.
Okay. But what happens is a lot of times the way we present treatment, and this is the way I used to do it, I would walk in at the recall. I'd have my mask on, my gloves, my glasses, sometimes loops. Some of you are even beyond that. You have a face mask on. And I mean, talk about being separated from your client. But what happens is we look at them. We say, oh, yeah, I see you need a crown, blah, 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 and then we walk out. Well, that's not a great way to develop a relationship.
Well, that's the way we develop the Crown of the Year Club. We do one crown. It's a pretty easy sale because the insurance company pays 50%, and they've got the patient between a rock and a hard spot, and you tell them they need a crown. What are their choices? And so they do it. But to sell the larger case, what Rise is saying, you've got to spend some time with these recall. And one of the things that we find with new clients we take on, we generally get a large bump in production. Dr. Kleber is on the phone. Did this year with us, and he started to sit down with recall patients, started asking questions and finding out what they wanted, and my gosh, production took off, and spending the time with that patient. Right, let's switch gears here a little bit.
Yeah,
you currently work 3 days a week. You're producing somewhere in excess of $1.5 million. Your overhead is somewhere in that 55% range. Tell us what your fees are.
My fees are high. Right now for any single unit, we just raised it to $2,500.
I might add, Rise has been at 23, and last summer I was in his office, and his team was asking him to raise it to $2,500. It's not
right.
Rise, it was the team. How do you...
It's partly because they see it being worth that, and it's also partly it's The Maria, particularly, she's certain that she can close the cases at 25. And so we just raised that. We're going to try it. And if it doesn't work, we'll back it down to what it was.
Mm-hmm. Tell us the things you do marketing-wise. I see from the book it said you're getting 15 to 20, 25 new patients a month coming to your practice. And that's really up from a few years ago. And again... what we found about these kind of cases is they do talk about you, but they whisper. No one spends $65,000 in their teeth and goes out and says their best friend says, gosh, you look nice. You look really rested. What'd you do, cut your hair? And they don't say, oh, no, I just spent a fortune on my teeth and they're all porcelain. They don't say that, we're finding. What are the marketing things you're doing?
Well, what we thought, or what I thought would happen, is you do a couple great cases, and then those people are going to be real excited, like we are. They seem to be when they first leave the office. And they're going to go home, and they're going to talk to all their friends and their relatives, and all of a sudden we're going to have this flood of people that comes in because they're so happy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are occasionally people that will do that, but the majority aren't that way at all. In fact, the better you get technically at doing it, and if you can truly do invisible dentistry, they tend to not talk about it at all. In fact, you really have to mine for it. You have to constantly badger them to get them to refer somebody because they are not going to tell people about it, especially when they pay a lot of money for it. Because I've had a lot of people say, I would never tell anybody what I spent on this. It's partly because they don't value themselves as much as I wish they would.
Mm-hmm.
They're almost embarrassed about it. They're perfectly okay with telling somebody they spent $65,000 on that car, but they're not perfectly okay with telling somebody they spent $65,000 on themselves. So what we hoped would happen at first was that we would be able to develop this system where pre-existing patients would just keep referring other clients, and that hasn't turned out to be true at all. In fact, once in a while we'll get one. And when we do, they're always great clients. I mean, they follow through. They know a lot about what we do. They know about the fee because that's usually discussed with their friend or relative ahead of time. But on the other hand, we still have to gain their trust. And I find that the best clients tend to be ones that are referred by those types of patients, but they're few and far between.
Yes.
So a lot of it now is coming from just marketing.
Yes.
Marketing being magazines specifically, the internet. And unfortunately, it costs a fair amount to do that. Our marketing budget is about 10%. And that's just the cost of doing business.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about your internet. What do you do on the internet? People are curious about this.
Well, the internet, when we first started doing it about 8 years ago, there weren't a lot of dental internet sites. Now there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the company that developed my site initially went on to kind of stamp it out, and there are a lot of sites that are better than mine now. What we found is that one of the keys to the internet is not so much what the site is, but that it comes up often. And you have to pay for that. In other words, you have to get people that work a search engine. That if people type in your locale and they type in the word dentist or cosmetic dentistry or whatever it is, you need to be first in first position. Or
so you spend quite a bit a month on that service to have your name pop up when people type in cosmetic.
Absolutely, yeah.
Seattle.
I can do some things real well. One thing I don't know how to do is to how to work a search engine being number one in that internet.
Mm-hmm.
So I pay people to do that.
Yes. Now tell us about your magazine ads. What do you do there?
The magazine ads, when we started doing them about four years ago, we started in more earnest. But the last year in particular, we've really changed a lot. Next year, we're going to even be higher. But
the magazine that rises in is Seattle Living. It's one of these glossy magazines that every city has, and they list all the dentists. And as a matter of fact, there are a number of dentists in Seattle advertising in this same magazine.
Yeah. And next year we'll be in 5 magazines every month. But what happens is that the ad really needs to be a reflection of you. And I've always been a strong advocate of if you do an ad in a magazine, the patient who's there needs to be one of your patients. It should not be a stock photo from somewhere because there's no validity to it. People want to know the story that goes behind that patient. So every ad I've ever done has been a client, and I happen to be a reasonably good photographer. So all
somebody's children, I'm going to interrupt for a minute. Somebody's children are speaking. If you could hit the 6 on your phone, it would disconnect your speaker, and we couldn't hear that, please.
But what happens is that the stories that go with those really make a difference. This last month, we ran a different photograph in the ad, and for some reason, that photograph has made a bigger difference. We've had about 12 good calls from this one ad. But part of the thing about marketing, especially in magazines, you just have to be consistent. And you can't do it 1 month. And this is what we tried at first. We do 1 month, and then we hang out for maybe 3 or 4.
I remember that. And that did almost nothing.
It did. Well, it did nothing.
Yes, you have to do it. How many months have you consistently been in those magazines at this point?
Well, we're every month now.
Yes, and that's right. One thing that I will point out. Any of you thinking about doing marketing, you have to have a serious marketing budget if you're going to go with media. If you're in an urban area, and if you're thinking about spending less than 10% of your gross on marketing, write down this address. Post Office Box 4578, Sun River, Oregon. Make the checks to Bill and Carolyn, and I'll tell everybody in your town I know about you, because that's about how much good you're going to get out of dabbling in marketing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's just about consistency. Now, obviously, the message needs to be the correct message, and we've done, I think we've got the right message right now, at least for the market. That's the other thing about it, is it's not consistent. You constantly have to look at, does it work, does it not, and then change as the time goes on. That's the one thing I've seen happen, especially the last couple of years.
I noticed one ad that you did as Seattle became more and more competitive at the high end. You ran one ad that says what to look for, how to select a cosmetic dentist, and you suggested that they be accredited with one of the accrediting agencies. You suggested several other things, and of course it fit your. It described you exactly.
Right. Well, it makes sense if you're going to market to describe yourself.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it's been interesting because I've watched what our competitors, and we do compete.
Mm-hmm.
In those magazines, there's about 5 or 6 of us that are there all the time. And how it's interesting how they've sort of evolved into the same thing. Everybody's got some sort of accreditation now.
Yes.
And that's the way it works.
Tell us a little bit about your balance between your practice and your free time. You work 3 days a week in your office. You probably spend another day doing office related things. You have your course that you teach. Rise has a course where he teaches 8 students at a time. They bring a patient, they prep 10 veneers, come back 3 weeks later and prep them. As a matter of fact, I think Dr. Clever, who's on the call tonight, just finished that course.
Yeah, I mean, I like my job. I can't say I love my job. I love free time, and I always have. So as soon as I was able to, one of my goals was to work less time, because that's the one thing that no matter how successful any of us become or how much money you make, you can never buy the time back.
Time is the one thing we can't purchase.
No, you can't. And so I decided 2 years ago to cut back to 3 days a week. Now, what's happening now is that we are really busy. I mean, I'm happy to be busy, but we're almost busy to the point where it's unmanageable. And we're trying to strategize of how we're going to handle, because it keeps going up. I mean, every month we just have more people that want to do this. And you can do some things, like you can raise your fee, and that tends to slow it down a little bit. And there's a point at which it becomes too expensive for the market. But on the other hand, I really enjoy the people that we work with. Some of them are challenging, but I enjoy the process. And we've extended our hours in the days we're there. So we work 3 12-hour days now.
It comes out to about 1,350 hours a year. And to give you an idea, if you work 180 days times 8, that's 1,200. So Rise, it's full time, only does it in 3 days a week.
Yeah.
Rise, tell us a little about your financial arrangements. I know that you said that you choose sometimes to give something away, but you don't give it away when you don't choose to. And I know that you carry... I believe in order to get an appointment in your practice, you basically pay in full before you make your first appointment or after you've decided to go ahead with treatment, something like that.
So the consults are free. We say complimentary, but we don't want a barrier in the way. And I've had a lot of individuals, my peers, arguing, well, why would you do that? Well, because I don't want that barrier there.
But I've always said I can go in and kick the tires of a Ferrari. I can probably take it for a test drive without putting a nickel down. But, yeah, I go into a dental office, and I know there's some clients, and not clients of mine particularly, but there are dentists out there that say that your time doing exams are every bit as valuable. And I ran into a client a few years ago in Calgary that went to a dental educational institution, and they convinced him that his time doing exams is just as valuable. We watched his new patient flow just go down to almost nothing. I couldn't figure what was going on. I didn't know he was doing this, and he was charging $350 for that exam and consult. And his argument was his time doing exams was every bit as valuable as his time doing preps. And I said, well, you've got me convinced, but you sure haven't convinced the patients in Calgary about this. And I think you're right on. Complimentary consultations, exams, and then very firm arrangements. So what are the arrangements for a patient? Let's say they choose to do 10 anterior veneers.
The arrangements are the same for every person, and they're fairly straightforward. It's you pay 100% before we start. That's it. Now, if they want to finance it, we've got financing options. We never carry the paper, ever.
I know you're carrying, you've had as high as a $300,000 credit balance in your practice. And I know for a lot of people on the call, that may sound absolutely incredible. And yet, one of the things I'd like all of you to get from this call is that if someone has done it, it must be possible. One of the things that I see in Rise's office is the absolute commitment on the part of everybody on the team to follow Rise's vision. And, of course, doing these kind of cases, if you don't get paid in advance, you'll find yourself never finishing a case because if they don't have to pay till it's finished, these things can go on forever. And this is a very simple thing we learned in dental school that the professor said, what's the denture that fits best? And the answer is it's the one that's paid for. Well, it's the same with these cases. So everybody pays before they start treatment.
Yeah, and there's a psychological reason behind that beyond the fact that it makes good business sense. The psychological reason is if you think about everybody you've ever owed money to in your life, and I've owed money to a lot of people, and I still have some people I owe money to. But the simple fact is, as the time goes on, I start to dislike those individuals.
Yes.
It doesn't matter who it is.
Yes.
It feels good when you get that new car, but as you pay that loan off over the next 2, 3, 5 years, it doesn't feel so good toward the end. In fact, you want to get rid of the thing.
Mm-hmm. Now they've got that figured out. I'd like to open this up to some questions from our audience tonight. If you have a question for Rise, if you could just hit the 6 button on your phone, open up your line, and ask a question.
Yes. This is Greg from St. Louis again. When, on that initial phone call, when you kind of when the team member at the front desk is kind of giving them an idea of kind of what's involved, et cetera, when you quote them a fee, which it sounds like you do, do you give them a range, or do you say, okay, this is good, you know, without ever having seen the person,
right.
you don't know if you're treating one arch, two arches, front teeth, something removable, something fixed. Do you give them a range? Do you say, oh, you know, this is going to cost you as much as a new car? What specifically are you sharing with that person to screen out the people that, you know, aren't interested, but yet not scare away the people that are?
I have to tell a quick story. When Rise did my case about 7 or 8 years ago, 28 units of bonded porcelain, and he did a very brief examination. He did his consult on the telephone. I'm here in Oregon. He's in Seattle. And I said, okay, I paid Rise full fee to do this case. Fortunately, I got it done before he raised his fees this much. But at the time, I said, okay, Rise, bottom line, what's this going to cost me? And he says, Bill, it's going to be $37,000. Now, I knew his fees, and I said, okay, Rise, what in the world are you going to do for $37,000? Now, remember, think of all of your fees 8 years ago. He said, for $37,000, Bill, I'll do whatever you want. So when Rise quotes a fee of $65,000, he can probably do pretty much whatever the patient wants. But go ahead, Rise. How does Maria find out?
So we never quote a range,
mm-hmm.
because the only number that people remember for range is
the
bottom one.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, well, this could be anywhere from, you know, $5,000 to $55,000.
I heard five.
Yeah, they only remember five. So if you're not sure, what we'll do is we'll give a per unit rate, and it's just multiples. That way it kind of leaves it open-ended. But the simple fact is that most of the time we know from what they've described what they're after. So a typical smile, for example, it's $15,000 or it's $25,000 or whatever your fee figures out to be. That's the number we say.
I have a client that we did a role play in a seminar recently. Client down in Southern California, Palm Desert actually, and he had a fairly new receptionist, and she'd been trained by us, and we did this role play in one of our seminars, and Kay Puschetti, one of our consultants, was the patient. And she was pretending she was on the phone, doing role-playing this phone call. And it's actually a script that she follows that she's practiced at and got very good at. And Kay was interested in having some veneers, and her story was that she had a doctor do four of them years ago, and they're fine, but they're not as good looking as they could be, and her daughter is a sophomore in college, and she wants to look more like her daughter, and you know what women want, and she wanted to look nice. And so she wanted to have some idea of what this would be. And my client's receptionist says, well, Kay, do you have a mirror handy? And Kay pretended she had a mirror in her hand. She says, give me a great big smile. How many teeth do you see? Kay said, well, I see 10. And this young receptionist said, well, Kay, you can probably count on that case being right around $15,000. Now, that's a doctor who charges about $1,200 a unit, but she added on $300 for contingencies. Now, the interesting thing about that receptionist, she's only been in dentistry for 3 weeks. She didn't know any better than to quote a fee.
So, and that's fairly similar to what we'll do. So, Maria will say, the typical smile is X amount of dollars. Now, it's just like, Greg, if you look at a car ad, they always have a lot of, they'll have a price on the car, but that's never what people end up paying. In fact, most of the time they spend a lot more than that you see. But basically what you're doing is you're pre-qualifying a person to find out they're interested enough to come in to meet you to the point they can really make the decision. Nobody makes that decision on the phone. I've never had a single case where they've decided on the phone. They always decide once they're in the door. And our goal with that phone call is there's only one goal, and that goal is to get them in the door.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Any other questions for Rise? You got an expert on the phone here, so take advantage of it.
Yes. This is Brad Tiller from South Carolina. I'd like to know what your restorative philosophy is. Are you neuromuscular? How do you feel about LVI versus Dawson-type CR?
Well, as my whole career has been this way, I keep evolving. I was an instructor at LVI for 4.5 years, and when I first was introduced to neuromuscular, I thought, wow, this is really great. The fact is, most of the cases we do are still based on that idea. We use the TENS quite a bit. On the other hand, last January, I did a joint lecture with Steve Ratcliffe, who is the clinical director of Panky, mm-hmm. and we did a comparison between CR, or at least the Panky approach to CR, and the neuromuscular from at least my perspective, and it was really quite curious how close they are. I think if you can kind of get around the names and you look at, you know, how the whole system's working, there aren't a lot of differences when you get down to the fine details, especially in how you design a case once you get beyond the starting point. The simple fact is, in the end, if you want longevity out of a case, you've got to match up the physiologic system the patient's working in, or I don't care what you make, whether it's a full denture, whether it's a single veneer, a filling, they don't work very well if you're outside of that envelope of function. And, you know, I will say that I've evolved a little bit more in that I kind of use a combination anymore. I'm not dead set on anything. This one client that I mentioned that I wish I'd never met, I set her originally using a neuromuscular system. I have now used everything from gravity to swinging a chicken over her head to try to decide where that bite needs to be. Because this isn't about dentistry in a lot of these patients anymore. Sometimes it's beyond that. It's about psychology, and sometimes it's more about control than anything else. But on the other hand, the thing I do like about the neuromuscular is that I have the ability to use EMGs and actually read those, and that gives me some more data. It's just like having an X-ray or anything else. But I'm not dead set on anything. In the end, what really decides whether or not you're successful, this is true of cosmetics or a TMD case, and when the patient says either I like it or they say it feels good, and that's how you really decide.
So you've really kind of been a combination of things, because I know when we first started, when we first started to work together, you were an instructor over at the University of Washington, and you were strictly centrifugalization at that point.
Yeah, that's all I knew.
And that's all you knew at that point, and then you evolved, and you got into neuromuscular, and then you came back. somewhere in between, and I agree. I took the similar path early on, but we're not into that tonight. Other questions for Rise about how the business side over the leadership side of his practice goes and how he creates this team of people that are all on the same song sheet.
Rise, Chris Kleber, real quick. What does it take to have you look somebody in the eye and say your fee's $100,000?
Well,
do they have to? I mean, do they have to piss you off or something like that? Or?
No. I mean, you know, the fact is, this one case that we're working on right now. Now, I'm not getting the whole fee. I'm getting out actually on this one. I'm getting $68,000 of it, and there's a periodontist. We're doing 16 implants.
Okay, that's what I figured.
In the end, even though that fee sounds high, and I think it's high. I mean, I'm glad it's not me. But on the other hand, when you look at the amount of time we're spending on this guy, this case is going to take about a year and a half, maybe 2 years to finish. We started,
probably a bargain at that fee.
Well, I think so. I mean, for what it's going to do for this fellow, he's going to have a new outlook on life. He already does. But if you figure out the per-hour rate, you're actually the most profitable, truthfully, is doing 10 units of veneers.
Mm-hmm.
That is by far the most profitable per unit time return you'll ever get. But on the other hand, if you misdiagnose those, and they are truly a case that's more than just a veneer case, because a lot of the people we see are in their 50s and 60s, they have really worn dentition, and that's usually a functional problem. So if you misdiagnose that, you put in nice straight white teeth, but straight usually means a little longer, then you start to deal with things like breakage and the glue doesn't hold and all those things.
You know, I have to say in bragging about Rise and his clinical skill, I had 16 gold onlays done in centric relation. We did hinge axis location. We did remounts. We did the whole thing. My anterior teeth had a little bit of wear. Not bad, because my occlusion had been protected fairly well. Rise put these in, 28 units of bonded porcelain, and I can't remember, it was 7 or 8 years ago, and I think I've broken one, and I had my knee surgery done, and they knocked one out with anesthesia when they intubated me. And I chew ice. I do not wear a mouth guard. I do everything that every dentist who puts porcelain in somebody's mouth would just cringe if I told them everything that I chew up. But it's incredible how this stuff holds up. Other questions for Rise?
Yeah, I've got one.
Yes.
Rise, was there ever a time, especially early on, when you made the change from a general practice to your vision, that you doubted yourself? And if so, you know, how did you handle it? In that time period?
Yeah. Who are you?
Stuart Levy.
No. Oh, Stuart? Yeah. Hell, Stuart, I still ask myself. I mean, last night, we were there till about 8 o'clock last night, and this last patient I saw was this lady I wish I'd never treated. I was asking Margaret, that's my wife, I said to Margaret, I said, why did I do this? You have days that you still question that, but yes, early on I wasn't sure.
Rise had a lot of calls to me late at night.
Oh, absolutely.
And I can tell you, there were a lot of calls. Bill, is this going to work?
Here's what I'll tell you about cosmetics, or you can bleed it over into TMD because they're very similar. The psychological parts are still the same. It's not the easy dentistry. If you want easy dentistry, do not go that direction. In other words, stay with doing, you know, the kids' profies and the crown of the year club or a filling once in a while. That is way easier. And in fact, some people do that really well, and they make a lot of money at it. If you want to do dentistry that for you, especially if you have a sort of artistic side hidden in there and you want to actually explore that and feel good about it, then cosmetics is definitely for you. But it is challenging, even now. I think I'm pretty good at it, but I'm not as good as I'll be in 5 years. And I know there are going to be people that are going to be challenges. They always are. And
he's saying that because he wants me to redo my work in 5 years. Watch.
Yeah. And then you get people like Bill that, you know, he was pretty easy to work on, but he makes me nervous, the fact that he doesn't wear a night guard. He doesn't do a lot of things I ask.
Choose ice.
Yeah, I know. Well, welcome to the real world, because your patients are going to do the same thing. I make every case a night guard, for example. I know that probably less than half actually wear it.
I've got a brand new one sitting in there, Brian.
Yeah.
Rise.
Yeah.
One of the things I'd like to say is I really appreciate Rise being on this call tonight, and while this is a highly niche practice, it really demonstrates that someone can absolutely follow their vision, pretty much regardless of whatever that vision is. We have some calls coming up where I'm going to do some what I will call more mainstream dentists. We're going to do one with Bernie Dunson next. Bernie is in Atlanta. I've got one coming up with a doctor in Seattle. It's a young doctor, just 4 years out of school, who's doing extremely well. He's also in our book. He fourth year out of school, he did $1.2 million and took half of it home. And his wife's a CPA, so we know the numbers are right. And it's strictly a general dentist in a small blue-collar shipyard town near Seattle. So these are all going to be different. If you have not read our book, it's available on the website. And if you're interested in the coaching that we do at Blatchford Solutions and you're on the call tonight, one of our enrollment consultants will give you a call. We'll call once. We're not going to bug you. If you're not interested, please have the courtesy at least to return the call and say you're not interested. But if you're not, you're always welcome to be on these calls and pick up what you can learn. I appreciate all of you being on the call tonight. I appreciate Rise for spending his time with this, and his practice is truly superb. If you get to Seattle, I'm sure he would welcome you to stop by and take a look. He's only open Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but it's right downtown Seattle. So thank you very much for being on the call tonight, and have a nice holiday season.